Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
All the envoys we had in the past, all of them, they didn't succeed for one simple reason, that Morocco did not want them to succeed, and he got the blessing and the support of the French and the Security Council. So unfortunately, we are not very much optimistic if we take the lessons from the past.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken welcomes the announcement of the new U.N. personal envoy for Western Sahara.
How will you arrest somebody on a crime that you say is an imminent crime or ongoing crime, and then you keep them in jail for 9 months without any judicial process?
Opposition groups call on the international community not to accept Benin's application to serve on the UN Human Rights Council.
I will be going back to Uganda after my fellowship and go back to do the work that I do in Uganda. No amount of intimidation can make me leave my own country.
And a leading Ugandan human rights lawyer takes residence at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government's Carr Center for Human Rights Policy. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has welcomed the announcement of the new UN personal envoy for Western Sahara, Stephane de Mistura. The top diplomat also says Washington supports the UN-led political process in Western Sahara to promote a peaceful and prosperous future for the people of the region. Mr. Mistura, an Italian-Swedish diplomat, was an Italian Undersecretary of State for Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation between 2011 to 2013. Meanwhile, the Polisario Front, considered by the UN to be the legitimate representatives of the Sahrawi people of Western Sahara, says the prospect of success of the newly announced UN Special Envoy are doubtful. This despite welcoming the appointment and pledging to work with the new envoy. Ambassador Mouloud Saïd is the representative of the Polisario Front in Washington, D.C. He tells me that the UN Security Council must assume its responsibility by supporting the new envoy to ensure the UN achieves its core objective. That goal will allow the people of Western Sahara to exercise their right to self-determination.
I think the position of the Sahrawi government and the French Polisario was made public as soon as after the appointment, which is that we're ready to cooperate with the UN envoy. But we believe that it's very important that the envoy will be supported by the Security Council and that the Security Council will assume its responsibility, because, as you know, the United Nations operation in Western Sahara has only one aim. And that goal is to ensure that the people of the Western Sahara can exercise the legitimate right to self-determination. So we hope that this will be the objective of the new representative, and we hope that the Security Council will support him in this task.
What does this mean for the Sahrawi people?
This is maybe the 10th envoy that the United Nations has appointed. We had in the past former Secretary of State James Baker. He was the envoy for 7 years. And we just had recently the former president of Germany, Mr. Kohler. Then before him, we have the U.S. Ambassador Christopher Ross. And the list is very long of envoys. And all of them, they could not succeed because the Moroccans did not allow them to implement the settlement plan, which was signed by the Sahrawis and the Moroccans in 1988.
So why would you think this will be different?
Unfortunately, we cannot be very optimistic, because we know that Morocco has not changed its position. We know that the Moroccans, they will not make his task easy. In fact, this his name was submitted to the parties many months ago. The Sahrawis accepted him when we were asked to accept him by the UN Secretary General. And Morocco, they just accepted it recently under a lot of pressure. So we know that the Moroccans have not changed their position or their intentions or their intransigence. So we're not very optimistic that he's going to really reach the objective that the United Nations has set on decolonizing Western Sahara, because Morocco and the French in the Security Council will not allow him to succeed.
The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, wrote on Twitter that he welcomes the announcement of the U.N.'s personal envoy for Western Sahara. It says the United States fully supports the U.N.-led political process in Western Sahara to promote a peaceful and prosperous future for the people of the region. What does this signify to you and the people?
That has been the traditional position of the United States to support any UN process in the Western Sahara. But the problem is that they should be more forthcoming when the meetings of the Security Council to make sure that that support will lead to implementing the United Nations settlement plan on the Western Sahara. I mean, everybody, we can say that they support the envoy, but it has to be not just in words, but on deeds. So we hope that the position of the United States at the Security Council will be much more aggressive and much more clear on making sure that the envoy is there to implement the United Nations resolution, in particular the right self-determination of the people of Western Sahara.
But you seem to have support from U.S. Senator Jim Inhofe, who basically welcomes the news as well. So you have two strong allies here.
We have more than that. We have the international legality on our side. You know, we have Africa. The Sahrawi Republic is a full-fledged member of the African Union as an independent country. We have, of course, Senator Inhofe, who has been very supportive of Western Sahara. We have Senator Leahy. We have so many other senators, so many congressmen that they are supporting this issue. But the problem is that when it comes to the Security Council, the Security Council did not assume its responsibility because, after all, they are the ones who are supposed to be the grantors of the international legality. And the problem we have is not the international support that we have, but the problem we have is with the Security Council that has to assume its responsibilities.
What are your expectations following the announcement of this special UN envoy, particularly since there have been others who were not able to succeed, I should say?
Unfortunately, the reason that made the others not to succeed, the same reason still there, which is that the Moroccans and the French will not allow him, because all the envoys we had in the past, or all of them, they didn't succeed for one simple reason, that Morocco did not want them to succeed, and he got the blessing and the support of the French and the Security Council. So unfortunately, we are not very much optimistic if we take the lessons from the past.
Ambassador Mouloud Saïd is the representative of the Polisario Front in Washington. He spoke with me from here in Washington. In Benin, opposition political parties, civil society groups, and human rights defenders are calling on the international community not to accept the country's application to serve on the UN Human Rights Council 2022 to 2024 session. This after Benin's Vice President Mariam Chabi Talata announced at the recently concluded UN General Assembly in New York her government's plan to be on the UN Human Rights Council. Making the case for Benin, the vice president called on members of the UN to support the country's candidacy, adding that the West African country has the endorsement of the African Union. The vice president also said Benin has a long track record of protecting and promoting human rights, an assertion critics deny. Citing ongoing human rights abuses and recent reports by both local and international human rights organizations, critics say the administration lacks the moral right to be seated on the UN Human Rights Council. Meanwhile, a former top Benin envoy to the U.S. has petitioned the White House, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and Congress to object to the West African country's request to be seated on the council. Ambassador Omar Aruna tells me that several groups have been compiling evidence of ongoing human rights abuses, which should be used to disqualify Benin from being seated on the body.
Yes, indeed. I did petition the U.S. government, the U.S. Congress, and as well as some other human rights organizations to oppose Benin entering into the Human Rights Council at the U.N. This is simple. I've done it because, for me, I think it is important that we don't allow human rights abusers to be part of that body. It seems like it's an affront. For me, it's an affront to even the world, the global community, to be to pretend to be sitting within that illustrious body when in the country since 2016, when President Talon took over the country's reign, that there is hundreds of Beninese who have been put in jail just for expressing their opinion or for making a choice to run against him for the highest office.
Why do you think the opposition or protest or petitions that you and other Beninese have signed to the UN and to the institutions in the US will have? What impact do you think it will have in preventing Benin from achieving its objective?
At least to the least, it will raise the issue about human rights in Benin. But we do really hope that those international bodies are not just a sounding board for dictatorship. Like you can see, it, if I want to draw a parallel with ECOWAS in West Africa, where they allow the situation to get out of hand, and then they're surprised that the people are rising up around in that community. Same thing with the UN. As a matter of fact, I'm not quite sure what impact it will have, because if you look at the Human Rights Council, the member of that Human Rights Council, I don't think it's something to be proud of.
Some people are suggesting that those who are opposed to Benin's request to sit at the UN Human Rights Council are just opposition politicians who just want to make the government unpopular in the eyes of the international community and Benin's international partners. How do you respond to that?
I would say that the government is doing a good job at making itself unpopular. To be really clear, look at the human rights record. When you see that Freedom House has downgraded Benin from being free for so many years to now partly free, is somebody who's making that happen? I mean, are we controlling those agencies that are downgrading Benin human rights record? The U.S. State Department 2020 Human Rights Report cites this, I quote, unlawful or arbitrary execution, including extrajudicial execution, are happening in Benin. Harsh and deadly prison conditions are happening in Benin. Severe restriction and press freedom and unjustified arrest and prosecution of journalists. Lack of investigation and accountability for violence against women. This is not what we are saying. This is what others are saying about Benin. So we cannot just whitewash those action, and because some other people pretend that we are doing this because we are political actor, that human rights does not have anything to do with politics. Politics is a side, human rights is a right, a human right. And when you go a perpetrate human rights abuses, this is a crime against humanity. Everybody is concerned.
Supporters of the government are of the view that those people you have mentioned as their rights being violated offended the law. They committed crimes for which they are facing the full rigors of the laws. Claiming that their rights are being violated, they argue, is a clever way of absorbing them from their actions. How do you respond to that?
If it is so true that they have committed crime, why are not they going to the justice system? Although we also know that the justice system is really corrupt in Benin, why are they not taking them to the judicial system and they're sitting in jail? I mean, how will you arrest somebody on a crime that you say is imminent crime or ongoing crime, and then you keep them in jail for 9 months without any judicial process?
Ambassador Omar Haruna is a former Benin ambassador to the U.S. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. A leading Ugandan human rights lawyer has taken residence at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government's Carr Center for Human Rights Policy here in the U.S. Nicholas Opiyo says he left Uganda following threats to his life. Until recently, Opiyo was the executive director of Chapter 4 Uganda, an NGO formed to support human rights and pro-democracy activists in their efforts to promote open government and defend human rights. Opiyo had been accused of using the Chapter 4 organization to fraudulently receive $340,000 as proceeds of crime. The accounts of the organization were subsequently frozen, and Opiyo was accused of supporting terrorism, arraigned in court and remanded in prison. Chapter 4 was one of the many NGOs that were closed down after being accused of failing to comply with regulations governing the operations of non-governmental organizations in Uganda. Opiyo denies the charges, which were recently dismissed by a court. He tells me that he left Uganda shortly after the charges were dropped and after receiving multiple threats to his life.
The last 2 years has been very, very difficult for me in Uganda. There have been a lot of misinformation, a lot of personal attacks, both from NRM party enthusiasts and actors within the state, that culminated into my arrest. All of this visited on me enormous mental stress and strain. And so when the charges were dropped, I took the immediate step to leave the country for my own mental health, but also for my own personal safety. I had begun to get numerous threats, many of which were on phone calls, on social media, people saying they would kill me. So I appealed to actors within the state who assisted me and got me out of town.
So what happens to your organization?
Well, the organization at the time I was leaving had been indefinitely suspended on the false allegation that it hadn't filed returns. At the time I left the country, we had provided adequate proof that all those allegations were false. We had filed all the returns, albeit in some cases late, but the returns were nonetheless filed. We had commenced administrative engagements with the government to provide a platform for explaining ourselves and for them to reopen the organization. We believed up until that time that the state will reopen the organization. Since I left, the board of governors of the organization have appointed someone in acting capacity, and that engagement is continuing with the state. In fact, we have a letter for an inspection of the organization by the NGO Bureau on Monday. Our board members and our staff members will attend to that. And if those processes fail, we shall seek other means of redress. But the organization will continue to be a going concern. Our donors have stood with us. Our supporters have stood with us. And our staff members as well are happy to go back to work tomorrow if the suspension is lifted.
Well, some people are suggesting that your presence in the U.S. and the way with which that was accomplished gives credence to your critics who say you are being sponsored by some Western countries to undermine Uganda's institutions and create disunity, terrorism, among other accusations. How do you respond to that?
Those allegations that have been labeled not just against me, but against the broader civil society organizations in Uganda, that they are agents of foreign power, simply on account of the fact that the main source of their funding is foreign. But nothing could be further from the truth. If I were involved in terrorism activities and undermining the state, then I should be locked up in jail if there's evidence to that. The fact that I'm still here and that no such charges have been labeled against me indicates that there's no evidence. Those are only statements aimed at impeaching our integrity and making us unpopular amongst the population we serve. The receipt of funds from foreign countries doesn't necessarily make one an enemy of the state. If it did, our own government will be its biggest enemy because it relies on donor funding. The private sector get money from venture capital funds around the world. And so that shouldn't be a big concern. My attendance of Harvard University really is nothing, but because Harvard is a pinnacle of higher education, it is revered worldwide. So it's a privilege for me to be admitted to Harvard. I don't get money from any foreign government, and the state knows that. We get money from foundations and private individuals. So for me, being at Harvard is an honor. It's an opportunity to learn, to expand my network, and go back to Uganda to do the work that we do back home.
I was going to ask you what you're going to do after your one-year fellowship at Harvard.
My family is in Uganda. My siblings are in Uganda. My whole life is in Uganda. My parents are now very old. My father is over 92 years old. The last thing I want to do is to stay very far away from them. I will be going back to Uganda after my fellowship and go back to do the work that I do in Uganda. No amount of intimidation can make me leave my own country.
Nicholas Opio is a Ugandan human rights lawyer. He spoke with me from Cambridge, Massachusetts, in the U.S. Nyanchang Worth Tai, a South Sudanese peace activist, has been shortlisted as a finalist for the United Institute of Peace, or USIP, Women Peace Building Award 2021. Ms. Tai is the co-founder and executive director of the Mother Care Organizations and head of gender programs at the Assistance Mission for Africa. She is credited with fighting to protect women and girls from sexual and gender-based violence. She also advocates for effective policy implementation that includes women's voices at the local and national level. The USIP Award, which coincides with the International Day of Peace, is given annually to a woman peace builder who has contributed significantly to ending conflict in her country. Officials say the winner of this year's prestigious award will be announced at a ceremony to be held on the campus of USIP on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. on October 20. For reaction to being among the finalists for the USIP Women Peace Building Award, I reached Nyanchang Worth Tai.
I felt honored, humbled at the same time, but also I was so happy to see where I come from, a country like South Sudan, whereby women, you know, live with all this stigma, stereotype, and their ability to contribute into positive change is always being doubted. Made me feel like the South Sudanese women have a space and they're being recognized globally. And I felt like it can just set the record, and it's just an inspiration for so many young people, especially young South Sudanese women who are coming up, to know that, you know, there is always a way and it's always possible. And whatever that you do, you can always be recognized for it.
Talking about being a peace activist, a human rights defender, what have you been doing for which you are being recognized?
I'm being recognized for my peace building work initiatives with Assistance Mission for Africa, and that's a regional based organization in East Africa with its headquarters in South Sudan. I have been leading the gender department, and I have been implementing a project called the National Action Plan for the UN Security Council 1325 on Women, Peace and Security. And most of my work has been involving around mentorship, around awareness raising, and around also women inclusion in decision-making processes. I have been involved with different women leaders and also with policymakers who can make things happen. But above all, I have been working with important groups, and these are survivors of sexual gender-based violence, around 120 women, and we call them the Beam of Hope. And these are women who lost everything, including also their dignity, because how rape is being identified as something that nobody wants to get associated with in South Sudan. These women working with them gave me inspiration. So I'm being recognized for the efforts that I made, including these women making their stories being heard and also linking them to different service providers, creating safe space for them, creating for them source of livelihood through different donors and different funders. And not only that, women in the traditional courts have been recognized, and currently we have women leaders who are sitting in the traditional courts as part of the chiefs.
What responses have you been getting from those who have benefited from the work that you've been doing?
One impact that I can say is that women in the traditional courts, they have been attesting and talking about how more survivors of sexual gender-based violence are coming out and reporting cases. And they kept saying that we feel safe enough when we report to a woman because we know that we are not going to be stigmatized, you know, and we know that our case is going to be taken seriously because that's a woman like us. She can understand our grievances and she can walk in our shoes. Another impact as well is that the Beam of Hope survivors, they wanted created an advocacy group among themselves. And the advocacy group women are women who are going within the neighborhood, is spreading the word of peace. And on top of that, encouraging survivors to come out and report cases. And for me, that is the sustainability aspect that I have been looking for it. And I felt like the work that we have been doing, it wasn't a hit and run, but it's a work that the community has taken upon itself, and it's going to continue for generations.
What do you see your organization achieving or accomplishing within the next 5 to 10 years?
What I can say is that from the next 5 to 10 years, Assistance Mission for Africa is going to achieve seeing women in key decision-making processes, women sitting in the table where people say that women should not belong into this table, because I have already seen how the gatekeepers, and these are the men and the boys, have been engaged in the process of the women peace and security, and how they have understood the importance of having women in decision-making processes, tables, and having women on board. Not only that, I'm seeing that in the future, it's going to achieve seeing survivors getting justice, and not only at the South Sudan level, but also at the international level, and it will be encouraging more women, and especially young girls, for mentorship programs for them to come out and to be leaders.
Nyachangworth Tai is a South Sudanese peace activist shortlisted as a finalist for the United Institute of Peace, or USIP, Women Building Peace Award 2021. She spoke with me from Brussels, Belgium. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Music from our African collection. But first, two Catholic priests from the Jesuit Refugee Services, or JRS, are in the U.S. to meet with students and members of the church to discuss their work in the Middle East and North Africa. Father Don Kuru, Regional Director for JRS in the Middle East and North Africa, and Father Joe Kassar, Country Director of JRS in Iraq, share their experiences and also talk about how their work is protecting people, including religious minorities forced to flee their homes. In part two of our interview, the Jesuit priest talked about the funding of their mission and their expectations of the scheduled meetings across the U.S. How do you get funding to support your work?
Well, one of the great reasons and the source of great gratitude, and one of the reasons we're here in Washington, is that PRM, which is a U.S. government agency, has for the last couple of years done extraordinary work in funding our programs in Iraq. So Father Joe is here really to say a tremendous thanks to PRM and the U.S. government for that. So that is our largest source of funding for Iraq. Our programs certainly in Syria and in Lebanon and in Jordan and the other three countries, most of them are funded by Catholic organizations, mostly in Europe, and the Jesuit Refugee Service here in the United States. So we get donations from lots of church-based institutions that are interested in integral human development for all people, Muslim, Christian, Druze, Yazidi, across the board. Which is our focus. We care for all who are vulnerable, but most of our major donors are Catholic organizations based in Europe.
What are your expectations of the anticipated planned meetings that you will be having with the authorities here in Washington?
Well, first of all, if we mention only PRM, which Dan has just referred to, I think one of the main items would be, well, to express gratitude, because that has really made a difference for us in terms of the kind of support that we're able to give to people on the ground and to respond to their needs in a time when funding, because of the COVID pandemic, was largely unavailable. So that has made a great difference for us to be able to continue with the same and increase even the level of support to people in very, very trying situations. So we'd really like to say thank you for that. On the other hand, together with the gratitude, there's the need also to continue to bring the voices of the people we serve. You know, somehow or other, media audiences can get accustomed to the fact that there are people who are forcibly displaced, and they, like many other problems that take a long time, and there is nothing new to report about them, they kind of fade away into the background. It is very difficult, it is heartbreaking, and it is very unfortunate that situations that involve human beings in such situations of need could fade into the background when people are really still in need and should benefit from the support of those who are in a position to help.
What is your core message to the people you will be meeting, and then to the people around the world who will be listening to you?
In a very clear, very short, it is do not forget the people of the Middle East. I think we see the terrible failure of a too soon, a too early withdrawal from Afghanistan. And we see that as a, there is a role, a valuable role for the United States to play in the circumstances of the Middle East. If we simply say that the Syria crisis, because it's been going on for 10 years, can no longer be an issue for us, the ISIS, the events of ISIS, because they happened 7 years ago, are no longer an issue for us. If we simply say that and fall into the easy tranquility of ignorance, then we fail to understand the desperate need today and the potential for much greater harm in the future. We have to pay attention to the issues at hand here. We have to look at the long-term need for instance, the ISIS survivors that we work with, the Yazidis and Christians who have survived the genocides of ISIS in northern Iraq. In order for us to work with them and to do real reconciliation work, that takes a long time. This needs a long-term investment from us as a country, from us as a people, and from the international humanitarian agencies, from the international community. And so I think this is a reminder for tomorrow. We'll be speaking with some folks from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, some of the staff members there, and that will be our ongoing plea to them. Do not forget the work that needs to happen here. We have been doing good work. This has to be maintained. None of these are short-term issues, and we can't just work on one particular political cycle or one annual or even a news cycle. We have to look at much longer-term results for these things.
Father Don Kuru is Regional Director for JRS in the Middle East and North Africa, and Father Joe Kasai is Country Director of JRS in Iraq. They spoke with me from here in Washington. Humanitarian aid would have to be cut for many of the nearly 10 million people in Democratic Republic of the Congo facing multiple crises because of lack of money, a senior United Nations official says. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
A UN official says a funding shortfall means it will be difficult for the United Nations to provide needed aid to Democratic Republic of the Congo. Conflict in eastern DRC has forced 5.3 million people to flee their homes, Africa's largest number of internally displaced people. Additionally, conflict in neighboring countries has prompted more than 500,000 refugees to flee to DRC. The UN resident and humanitarian coordinator in DRC, David McLachlan Carr, says millions of people in the eastern provinces are victims of long simmering inter-ethnic conflicts and conflicts over natural resources. He says the situation is particularly concerning in Ituri, North Kivu, and South Kivu provinces, as well as territories in northern Tanganyika. These protracted conflicts, he says, have left millions of people destitute and in urgent need of assistance. He says it will be difficult to provide that aid because only 27% of the UN's nearly $2 billion appeal for this year has been funded.
Impacting our ability to reach the most vulnerable. And those populations, of course, leave us with a very stark choice. Who do we assist when we have such reduced amounts of assistance? Forcing us to prioritize in the DRC, which is a vast country with multiple crises.
For example, he says the country is prone to repeated epidemics of many diseases, including Ebola, cholera, measles, and malaria. Currently, he says, the DRC is facing a lethal meningitis outbreak. McLachlan Carr says a recent World Food Program and UNICEF survey found 26.7 million people suffering from acute hunger.
And they're literally living day to day in a precarious situation with an inadequate nutritional intake leading to essentially a weakened condition, which of course makes them more prone and vulnerable to disease across the country.
McLachlan Carr says priority needs include food, shelter, health care, water and sanitation, education, as well as psychosocial counseling for victims of gender and sexual abuse. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas in Puga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. It's international break in football and a busy week for African national teams in the 2022 World Cup qualification. Ghana had a home victory over Zimbabwe. The Black Stars, beaten by Group G rival South Africa last month, won 3-1 in Cape Coast. Ghana are on 6 points, one behind leader South Africa, after Bafana Bafana won 3-1 away in Ethiopia early on Saturday. Elsewhere, Guinea was held to a 2-2 draw by Sudan in a match played in Morocco following the coup in Guinea last month. Sudan have 2 points in Group I, while Guinea are on 3 points, 3 points behind leaders Morocco. The Atlas Lions face Guinea-Bissau, who lost 5-0 on Wednesday in Casablanca. In Group H, Togo and Congo drew 1-1 to leave both countries without a win after 3 matches. Group leaders Senegal beat Namibia 4-1 on Saturday. Nigeria suffered a shock 1-0 defeat to the Central African Republic on Thursday. This was the Super Eagles' first home defeat in a World Cup qualifier since October 1981. Central African Republic are 2 points behind Group C leaders Nigeria. Algeria beat Niger 6-1 as Burkina Faso kept pace at the top of the group thanks to a 4-0 win over Djibouti in the Moroccan city of Marrakech. Both Algeria and Burkina Faso have 7 points after 3 matches. Niger host Algeria on Tuesday. Egypt moved back on the top of Group F after a 1-0 win over neighbors Libya. In the same group, Angola beat Gabon 3-1. Early on Friday, Cameroon beat Mozambique 3-1 in Group D, and Ivory Coast beat Malawi 3-0 in the South African city of Johannesburg. Also on Thursday, Cape Verde beat Liberia 2-1, DR Congo beat Madagascar 2-0, Benin beat Tanzania 1-0, and Zambia lost to Equatorial Guinea 2-0. Uganda beat Rwanda 1-0, and Mali thrashed Kenya 5-0. There are more other qualifiers coming up this week. In athletics, the 125th Boston Marathon takes place tomorrow, Monday, October 11th. Kenya's Edna Kiplagat and Ethiopia's Lelisa Desisa are among the former champions returning to compete as the World Athletics Elite Platinum Label Road Race makes a comeback after almost 900 days. Following cancellation and postponements due to the pandemic, this year's race will be the first held outside of its traditional Patriots Day date in April. Meanwhile, Athletics Kenya President Jackson Tuwei has confirmed that his nation has submitted a bid to host the 2025 World Championships. According to media reports, Tuwei feels that Kenya's history of producing world-class athletes gives them a rich chance of becoming the first African host of the global event. Kenya has a rich history in middle and long distance athletics, boasting 60 world and 34 Olympic champions, and currently holds 8 women's and 9 men's world records. Kenya hosted both the Under-20 World Athletics Championships earlier this year and the Under-18 version in 2017. World Athletics will announce the hosts of the 2025 World Championships in March of next year. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The situation in Guinea continues to be calm, and the people of Guinea seems to be willing to listen to the military regime in these difficult times. Yet, it would appear that the relationship between ECOWAS, the sub-regional group, and the military junta is wobbling. We know why. ECOWAS had no other alternative for to take the action it has taken, suspend Guinea and impose targeted sanctions. On the other hand, many Guineans and the leaders of the coup feel frustrated because they believe at a time when the former president, Alpha Conde, was changing the constitution in order to have a third term, and that there were protests in Guinea and they were confronted by security forces and there were bloodshed, neither ECOWAS nor the African Union came to the rescue. So they seem to be resenting the fact that after the coup, ECOWAS and even the African Union were dictating terms to the military regime. This is all and good, but there's need to know what the future relationship will be. Thus far, the military government has not responded positively to two demands of ECOWAS: immediate release of Alpha Conde and to have a transition not longer than 6 months. The military regime has now announced that Colonel Dumbuya will be the interim president for a transition government without specifying the duration of that government. Political parties that have spoken have said clearly that 6 months is not enough, that a lot of things must be accomplished before they return to civilian rule, such as writing a new constitution, changing the electoral system, and they feel a longer period is needed. But even though things seem to be calm and that Colonel Dumbuya seems to have won the confidence of a large group of the country, there is a risk that should be avoided. One should not have the emergence in Guinea of a one-man rule. It is therefore necessary for the military regime to be more clear, more transparent as to how decisions are arrived at before they are announced. It is true that there have been consultations with a variety of groups in Guinea, but no one knows who are the inputs of these decisions. The interim president has taken actions which have been approved widely by Guineans, but this is not enough. And let's see why this is not the case. Look at Tunisia. Tunisia, after much turmoil, had an election. A non-political leader was elected president with strong support, but he became frustrated with the slow pace of the work of the parliament, and he decided to dismiss parliament and commence taking decisions by himself. Some Tunisians felt this was a coup. Others initially felt that he was not violating the constitution. But right now, there seems to be a frustrated that he was not consulting widely. He has recently made a change of direction and appointed the first woman prime minister in the Arab world. But still, there is no clarity as to what will emerge in Tunisia, and the turmoil therefore continues in that country. And when you look at Sudan, you have a similar situation. After serious conflict between the military and social groups, political groups, both groups, the military and civil society groups, met, have long negotiations with the African Union providing good offices. They agreed on the composition and duration of a transition period. But after passage of time, we now see in the last few weeks, there are some conflicts which have been hidden from the public. A failed school and arms and ammunition are being found very close to Khartoum. This is why ECOWAS, despite its suspension of Guinea, should take certain imaginative and discreet diplomacy. For example, the chairman of ECOWAS can appoint a personal representative to reside in Conakry, where that individual will maintain contacts, discreetly or not, with the military regime and with social groups in the country with political parties so that the chairman will be kept fully informed of developments that will enable ECOWAS and the regime to make the change in the direction. This is vital if we are going to see a stable situation in the Guinea in the long run. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Cause in domino effect, you don't need introduce to yourself. Michael Jackson, Thriller, you are better. You I see you for dark, have you girl?
Sure?
The way your body take you, the bend. Girl, I just want me to rock. Girl, I just want me to vibe. Girl, I just want me with you like that's what I'm your mama. She ain't pay my dear. This spend you my paper. After tonight, I go live to the simulator. Pass on a vendetta. Against me, cause of you, I got many haters. Yeah, I grab something, oh something. Like it's your birthday, go shawty. My worry, nobody fit to take your place, baby, shake something. Them no feel you had better for mosquito. If them get for me, pass it 1 kilo. Got my eyes on the prize of my baby, you. Want to take to your pampana do pillow. Mama let, don't you forget. Me, I be cocky, but now I depesh. I don't default, baby, to get. Back as it causing domino effect. You no need introduce to yourself. Michael Jackson, Thriller, you are better. If I say you for dark, I feel
sure?
The way your body take you, the bend. Girl, I just want me to rock. Girl, I just want me to vibe. Girl, I just want me with you like I swat I'm your mama. She ain't pay my dear. Be spend you my paper. After tonight, I go live to the simulator. Pass on a vendetta. Against me, cause of you, I got many haters.
Girl, I just want me to rock.
Was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Bill Eagle, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the hand that rocks the cradle rules the nation and its destiny. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.